gifts. Good morning, Father, Son. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Welcome to Shaman's Keep. This is Caroline Wise-King, your host, and I have a great show for you today. We've got a wonderful guest, and there's going to be so much to discuss with her that I'm going to pretty much go right into the guest interview. Her name is Angeles Arian. She's a cultural anthropologist, award-winning author, educator, consultant, and founder and president of the Foundation for Cross-Cultural Educational Research. Her book, The Fourfold Way, has been translated in over 10 languages around the world. And the Fourfold Way program she developed is currently being used in medical, academic, and corporate environments. She's received 3 honorary doctorate degrees in honor of her work, and her lifelong dedication is to revealing ancient wisdoms shared by diverse cultures worldwide. It's a very wonderful thing to welcome you to our show today, Angeles. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my honor and privilege, and thank you so much for this wonderful program that you offer. It's just a pleasure and an honor to be your guest today.
Oh, thank you, Angeles. You know, we're all working together for the good of Mother Earth. Okay. You know, the work that you're doing in bringing back an understanding of the ancient belief systems of what we call the first peoples of the world is so important today. Could you tell us a little bit about the 4 worlds that make up our planetary family and how the first people's belief is so different from the dominant worlds?
Well, almost 35 years ago, I wanted to take a look at what are the points of unity worldwide, and are there universal ways, and particularly based in the perennial wisdoms and the indigenous wisdoms worldwide. And I found that every culture of the world has a way of the warrior, and warrior is an old-fashioned term for leadership. But every culture of the world also has the martial arts or some form of the martial arts, and also sports as well, and also ways of governance. And so that falls into the way of the warrior, or the modern day term for warrior is leadership. And also all cultures of the world have a medical model, and not only a traditional medical model, but they also have a folk medicine model or a complementary medicine model, or what we might call an integrative medicine or alternative medicine ways as well. And they run parallel with each other in each culture of the world. There's a traditional way of healing people, and then there's an alternative modality, mm-hmm. which is called a folk medicine way, or what might be considered the most ancient ways of healing. And then every culture of the world has a way of manifesting their life purpose or their life calling or their creativity, because human beings are really here for two purposes: one, to learn about love and to express love, and the other is to contribute and to serve and to create and to manifest your life dream. And so every culture of the world has the creative arts, the performing arts, whether it's art, music, dance, song, writing, bringing our life dreams into focus. And that's the way of the visionary, which is bringing our visions to earth, or our calling or a purpose to earth, or manifesting our gifts and talents or our creativity. And all cultures of the world have a way of bringing beauty into the world through their rituals and ceremonies as well. And all cultures of the world ritualize the four great mysteries of birth, marriage, initiation, and death. And then we have the way of the teacher, or the wisdom way. All cultures of the world transmit their values through storytelling. Storytelling is the oldest teaching healing art in the world, and transmission of wisdom ways, transmission of values, through education. And all cultures of the world have a means of education or transmitting skills or values that are essentially important to be passed on from generation to generation. And so these and indigenous peoples believe that the mark of a healthy person is one who is as strong in their leadership as they are in their ability to manifest their life dream or their creativity or their healing or their teaching ways. These are the four universal ways. And so the way of the warrior is to show up. The way of the healer is to pay attention to what has heart and meaning. The way of the visionary is the authentic self, to tell the truth without blame or judgment in all our relationships and in all our work and creativity. And the way of the teacher is to plan well and prepare well, but to be open to outcome, not attached to outcome.
Mm. So, yes, those are the four archetypes that you described in the fourfold way. And
yes,
it was wonderful when I came across your book years ago. And you not only talked about the strengths and the powers of each archetype, but you also gave the shadow side of each archetype. And this helped me recognize some of the traits in myself that I'd never understood. It was shocking at the time, but it was also a relief, because you said that if any of these traits were pronounced, it meant that there was significant positive power there if the person could recognize their shadow self and rise above it. Would you talk a little bit about the shadow side of each of these archetypes?
Well, the shadow side of the warrior is the rebel, you know, or the shadow side of leadership. And if I'm a great rebel, or if I don't honor other people's limits or boundaries, on the other side of that, waiting to be claimed, is a huge gift in leadership. And so it's good to recognize the shadow part. The shadow part of the healer is the victim or the aggressor, which would be the bully, the intimidator, or the victim who guilt induces others to take responsibility for their actions rather than their own actions. And the shadow side of the visionary is fixed perspectives, and the inability to look at the whole as well as the parts. And the shadow side of the teacher's high criticality and judgmentalness. And if I have high criticality and judgmentalness, then on the other side of that, waiting to be claimed as wisdom or discernment, or being the fair witness, or the objective mind, or fair self-talk.
Right. You know, in the way of the healer, You talk about four universal addictions that are part of the shadow side of the healer. And I think most people, when they hear the word addiction, they automatically think of alcohol or drugs. But you went much deeper. You unearthed the real nature of the surface addictions that we see in society. Would you talk a little bit about the actual addictions that are driving people?
Sure. Worldwide, we see the symptoms, which is drug, alcohol, food addictions, or sexual addictions, are really symptoms of deeper universal addictions that we have. For example, the addiction to intensity. Many of us have an addiction to intensity because of the fear of boredom. And on the other side of an addiction to intensity is a desire to truly experience the passionate heart without drama or collapse, and to experience deep peace and solace. And then we have the addiction to perfection, and there's a difference between perfection and excellence. Perfection doesn't tolerate mistakes, either of self and others, whereas excellence always explores trial and error and is the adventurer, the explorer who wants to discover, and excellence always learns from trial and error and comes to another standard of excellence or effectiveness. And then we have the addiction, and on the other side of perfection, if I'm a perfectionist and can't tolerate my own mistakes or my own fallibility or others, then on the other side of that, waiting to be claimed is excellence or right use of power. And then we have the addiction to the need to know, and underneath that it's important to be well-informed and well-educated, but to be addicted to the need to know, underneath that is somebody who has high control and lacks a lot of trust. On the other side of that, waiting to be claimed is wisdom and discernment and objectivity. And then many of us are addicted to looking only at what's not working, then what is working, and what is on the other side of that is a great visionary, someone who can look at the whole as well as the parts. But most of us either look at the whole and forget the parts, or we look only at the parts and forget the whole. And if we're constantly looking at what's not working in our life, pretty soon it won't work because that's all we're focusing on, because wherever we have our attention, it will always amplify or appreciate.
Right. You know, I keep telling people that whatever you send your attention to is what's going to grow in your life. You're giving it energy.
Yeah,
so
totally.
You want to send it to good things. You know, but how would somebody, for instance, somebody that is addicted to what is not going on right in their lives, how do they turn that around?
It's what I call a grateful seeing, is the ability to start first with what is working in my life, because what's really true, a lot is working, and in fact, more is working in my life than is not working. But I have to start with that, not to deny what's not working, but at least to start with that. And that's why the practice of gratitude is very important, because gratitude keeps the heart open, because it's impossible, absolutely impossible, to give gratitude from a closed heart. So if there was one practice that anyone could do, is to really, on a daily basis, to give gratitude, or to start first with appreciation for all that is working in my life, and to give gratitude for that, because the truth of what's so is more is working than not, but it's just that I'm so focused, if I have the addiction to what's not working, is constantly taking for granted what is working and just focusing on what's not working, so I'll get inconsistent results.
So it's sort of like saying count your blessings first. Look
right.
at all the things that are good in your life
right.
and focus on them, and the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah, and sort not of. To deny what's not working.
Right,
not to deny
right.
it, but at least to start the day with an intention of what's working and to give gratitude for that, or, as you said, to count the your blessings.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, that's food for thought. And on the other one that caught my attention was the need to know. I have a friend that is very, passionate about needing to know everything that's going on in the world and why it's going on and who did it. And, you know, it's and it's like a, you know, it's like a judgmental thing in a way. Because, you know, then you can say, well, they were wrong or this was right and that's wrong and all. And how do they turn that around?
Well, it's interesting is the opposite of control is trust. And I always know when I'm not trusting an issue or situation in my life, when I'm either pushing or striving or resisting or holding back. And there's a difference between curiosity. You know, our work is to really expand and strengthen our curiosity so it's greater than our criticality or our scrutiny or inquisitiveness that is tied with judgment, mm-hmm. which is not curiosity.
Right.
Curiosity is a part of the adventurer or the explorer or the discoverer, really bringing genuine interest to a situation or curiosity. And
yes, it is.
You know, and wisdom always, you know, anyone who embodies wisdom has a great deal of curiosity. The way of the teacher is the curiosity.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Greater.
We research everything.
Yeah.
And we have to, you know, see all the sides of it.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so a need to know is not exactly the need to understand as much as it's right. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's well said, I think. There's a difference between the need to know and to understand.
Yes, a huge difference.
Yeah.
Okay. And the intensity thing. I live in an area where there is a lot of intensity. Las Vegas is an intense city, with a lot of things to stimulate people's senses, and it's a lot of chaotic energy. But the underneath all these appetites, there's this need for intensity. That's what's driving these people?
Well, there's the fear of boredom, or there's the fear that they're not, you know, I'm not alive unless it's intense.
Mm. So it takes a lot to make
you know,
them feel alive.
To feel alive, you know. So underneath that, there's a fear that is driving that need to make mountains out of molehills, or to create drama so that I feel like I'm alive. Rather than recognizing the natural state of the human being is one of balance, rather than the extremes of drama or collapse or intensity that keeps driving us. Because nature's rhythm is medium to slow, and we're creatures of nature, and nothing moves fast in nature unless it's in danger, and it will move only for 15 or 20 minutes, and then it'll come back into its natural rhythm. So many of us are out of our natural rhythm, and we're in the fast lane, and that addiction to intensity leads to high stress, it leads to high burnout, and it's unnatural to the human spirit to be constantly in a state of intensity. And underneath that, you know, on the other side of that, you know, that's waiting to be claimed is balance and solace and the passionate heart. Most people in high drama, if you just ask them how they're feeling, they don't know how they're feeling. They're involved in the drama of it, the intensity of it, rather than and often running from feelings or overcompensating to repress some feelings that are coming up.
Yes, it seems to me a lot of it is escapism. It's
absolutely. Yeah. Running is another form of running.
They're trying to avoid thinking about something that they don't want to think about or that troubles them or whatever. Well, the wonderful thing about your book, and it was very empowering to me and other people, I'm sure, that have taken your course, it gives ideas and rituals for how to empower ourselves. And you use the drum a lot, you use the rattle, all the things that we use in shamanism that
they're the oldest instruments, you know. It's the first instruments, of course, were percussion instruments, were our hands and our own voice. In the first extension of instruments was the clicking of sticks and the clicking of bones, and it was used primarily for breaking patterns or for clearing work or purification work, the sound of the clicking of sticks or the clicking of bones. And the drum is found on every continent of the world, and even in Ethiopia today, the news is drummed. And the drum has been used for communication and for healing and for celebration and for entertainment worldwide. But it's humankind's imitation of the heartbeat. And the rattle is still the instrument that worldwide we give to all our babies. So there's a subliminal knowing of its or remembering of its power, because it's humankind's imitation of rain. And rain is cleansing and purifying and life-giving. And it's the instrument cross-culturally of the warrior. And the largest rattle collection in the world is at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, has the most worldwide collection of rattles from around the world that have been used in shamanic traditions and have been used in various ways for healing or for soul retrieval work or for protection work. And then we have the bell. Many traditions of the world have used ankle bells or have had bells on their headdresses or ceremonial gowns or vests, because they often believe it's the sound that the demons can't tolerate or the sound that awakens us to remember our life purpose or our life calling.
That's wonderful, and that's something else I'm going to talk with you about, because you talked about original medicine in that book, and it was a concept that I had never heard, and it was very, it was a great relief to me to know that, you know, we all worry about, do I have a purpose? Why am I here? What is it I'm supposed to be doing? Because we've forgotten, we weren't taught about original medicine. Would you explain a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. Indigenous peoples of North and South America refer to each human being as original medicine, that we're nowhere else duplicated in the world. But also science has stated that each one of us have our original gifts and talents, and we have our original tests and challenges as well. But research has shown, even with identical twins, that no two human beings on this entire planet have the same imprint or fingerprint. And if we were to put everybody's voice on a sonogram, even with identical twins or triplets, is the voice patterns are completely different. That's why we can recognize people's voices, voice patterns on the phone or the sound or their sonic. And ophthalmologists or eye doctors for many years have recognized, even with identical twins, is that the color or the texture and the pigmentation of the eye is completely original in every human eye. So what does that say about the human species? That we've come here, we have an original contribution or imprint to make, and it's imperative that we give voice to our vision and what we see, because our sound of our voice is completely original. And also, we have something to contribute with our own vision and perspective and insights and foresights as well. So it's interesting to me that many of the indigenous languages of the world, and the very old ancient languages, in their language, they don't have a means of comparison, like, you know, bigger, smaller, better, best, any of that, which supports that belief that we're original medicine. So what a waste of time it really is to compare or compete, because we're not duplicated anywhere in the world, and no one will, you know, meet another you. You know, you have a particular sonic and imprint and vision, and obviously with this program, you know, you're offering something from your own original medicine that's nowhere else duplicated.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I wish we had more of that concept in our culture, because everybody's worrying about being a size 4, a woman, we're worrying about looking like the model they saw on TV and comparing themselves most often unfavorably with what they're seeing out in the world. And they're somehow, people are so quick to say, oh, I'm not good enough somehow. And if only they could understand how perfect and wonderful they are just the way they are, because they are original medicine.
That's right.
We have to.
It's a beautiful term. It's a beautiful term. It doesn't mean, you know, specialness, or it doesn't mean entitlement or elitist in any way. It's just that we're nowhere else duplicated. And as a human species, you know, we belong to the human species, Homo sapiens sapiens, which means people who know what they know. And so we're just remembering people that know that they know, that know what they know. And we're in a process of deeply staying connected with that deep remembrance as a human species that, you know, we're creatures of the earth and we're original medicine, and we're here to learn to express love and to learn about love, but also to create and serve and make a contribution that will assist the generations of the future.
Absolutely. You know, the great tapestry of life is made up of so many colors and nuances. And if each person, it's because of this original medicine that each person, their particular color and shape and everything is what makes up this beautiful tapestry of life. And if they're not honoring themselves and what they're bringing to the tapestry, something is lost. You know?
Yes, absolutely. And we're here for a purpose, otherwise we wouldn't have a body. And we'll be here as long as we, you know, I love a common question and belief that, you know, that beautiful phrase, life is that a luminous pause between two great mysteries, which are one, birth and death. And mm-hmm. when we're born, we come in literally with two companions that follow us from the cradle to the coffin. And death is a lifelong companion that stands on our right, and stands on our left, and destiny is on our right. And death asks us a question every day, and so does destiny. And death's question on the left side of our body every day is, are you using the great gift of life well? Are you using the great gift of life well? And destiny is standing on our right, asking us a persistent daily question, which is, are you doing what you've come here to do? Are you doing what you've come here to do?
That's a wonderful story, and I have heard them loud and clear most of my life. They have not let me rest.
For all of us, those are the two great questions.
Yes, and it does give you a sense that you need to make your life count for something. That there has, you came here for a reason, and you must make your life the value that it is. You must honor that and do whatever you can to make it a better world than the one you came into.
Yes.
So
yes,
we keep
for ourselves and others. Yes.
Yes. You talk about the four-chambered heart, mm-hmm. and that's a wonderful concept too. Would you explain that a little bit?
Sure. We all have a four-chambered heart, but many traditional peoples of the world actually name the chambers. The top two chambers they call the full heart and the strong heart. And the bottom two chambers they call the open heart and the clear heart. And so it's often interesting to see where in my life am I fully engaged, where I'm full-hearted, and where have I been brave and truly courageous, the strong heart, and where is my heart open, because many of us have a Dutch door on our hearts where we appear very open, but there's just so far that you can get in. And then the clear heart, there's nothing that creates more safety than clarity. And the clear-hearted chamber, there are clear yeses, there are clear noes, and there are clear I don't knows. The heart doesn't ever overanalyze. So when I find myself second-guessing or overanalyzing, I know I'm not in my heart. And the opposite of full-heartedness is half-heartedness. So it's important to track where I'm half-hearted in my life, because it usually signals something I've outgrown and I've hit a ceiling on it, or it signals that I haven't made a real full commitment. I'm not really, and where I haven't, then I'm not reliable. I'm showing up inconsistently, or I find that it's just a duty or a should rather than a want. And so it's important, the shadow side of the full-hearted chamber is half-heartedness. And the shadow side of the strong heart or the brave heart or the courageous heart is weak-heartedness, wherever we're conflict-avoidant or we're involved in appeasing or pleasing behaviors or seeking acceptance and approval rather than standing in our own integrity. And then the opposite of the open-hearted chamber is closed-heartedness. And closed-heartedness shows us where we have forgiveness work to do, where we're still holding on to old grudges or disappointments or resentments or vengefulness. And then the opposite of the clear-hearted chamber is doubt or confusion or hesitation or reservation, and just all over the place. And and the heart is really never in doubt or confused. It just is saying things like, well, I know this person is somebody new in my life, and I love them very much, and I'm very clear about this part of our relationship, but I'm not clear about this part in our relationship. And the heart can just name that, and that's it, but doesn't second guess, doesn't overanalyze. It just says, this is what I'm clear about, this is what I'm not clear about.
Wow. That's awesome to have all of those chambers
and
open
work with
like
them.
They should be. Yes.
Yeah, we work with them every day, you know. And what I love about the muscle of the heart itself is that it's a muscle that always has, it beats, but there's always a rest between beats. That always incorporates rest. And it's the breath and the heart are always in the present. They're not in the past or the future. So if I have trouble staying present, it's to come back to the heartbeat, because it's in the present, and or to come back to my breath, because it's in the present. It's not in the past or the future. And the power of choice is in the present, and we have to show up. And many people, with all the distractions these days between cell phones and internet and faxes and so on, is many times we're not in the dream that we're in. We're in multiple other dreams, and we're not really present, and therefore not able to make effective choices in the dream that we're in. And if we can, the only way we can course correct the past and create our preferred future is to show up in the present, to make clear choices in the present. And
yes,
that's the clear chambered heart.
Sun Bear, who is a friend of mine many years ago, he's been gone quite a while now, but he used to say, now is the moment of power.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's a great
now.
Phrase. Yeah.
Now,
and that's called
moment.
Now.
Yes.
The
be
moment of power
right
is now.
This is where the power is. This is where you have choice.
Yeah.
Because it's the only place you have choice.
Yes, that's right.
And so you need to stay in the now. And there's so many wonderful things in your book. The way of the visionary, the way of the teacher sounded rather Zen-like. There was an emphasis on detachment, objectivity, and silence. And, of course, you and I know the greatest teacher of detachment is loss. And in today's hard economic times, we've got a lot of people experiencing loss of homes, loss of jobs, loss of status, loss of self-esteem. Would you share a little bit about how ritual can be used and has been used throughout history to acknowledge the loss and to deal with it in a good way?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because we're in the season of the fall right now, and I think the season of the fall is such a teacher in letting go and letting be. The leaves fall in the fall, but in the fall also is the only season of the year where there are really two functions, which are harvesting, which is an experience of abundance and fruitfulness, and also simultaneously letting go. And in high transitions, human beings experience five transitions all the time, and transitions' whole function is to provoke growth and to help us continue growing and unfolding and becoming more of who we are. And so the five transitions that we're constantly in, maybe in one or more, and if we're in all five at the same time, we're in what's called great growth or great transition. Many of us are experiencing that we're in a transition in relationships, or we're in transition in work, or we're in transition in finances, or we're in transition in health, or we're in transition in role identities, or different roles. We're letting go of certain roles, and new roles are emerging. But I love, you know, the grace and ease and beauty in which leaves fall from a tree. And I had once watched a leaf fall from a tree and discovered that it was the spore of the new leaf that was pushing, so that it could be born. And since I've seen that, I really trust that wherever there's a loss, there is making room for something new. Because again, as I said earlier, life is that a luminous pause between two great mysteries, birth and death, which are one. And the season of the fall is where that archetype, well, every season has its own variety of death, rebirth, but letting go, letting be, and opening to what is emerging.
Yes, you know, we in shamanism we say that the circle of life goes round and round.
Yes, it does. You can count on it. There are two things. There are two things we can count on in life: is our death and change. Those and, are the two constants.
Yeah, well, the round and round, you know, it's like the leaf dies, but a new birth is happening at the same time.
Right.
And so, you know, our lives are very similar to that. We go round and round, just like all the cycles of nature.
Right.
Where, you
right.
know, where we see the sprout come up and grow, and then grow to fullness and bloom and bear fruit, and then it withers and dies in the winter, and then spring, it's alive again, you know. And so we just have this circle that goes on endlessly. And if people could, we'll just understand that rhythm.
Yes, and the seasons, you know, are really tied with the four archetypes as well. You know, winter work is warrior work and regathering ourselves and regathering our power. And spring is the healer, new emergence. And summer is the visionary coming to full fruition. And then the fall is both harvesting and letting go. And then the cycle begins again.
Yes. Okay. That was another point that I loved about your book. When you talk about staying within the sacred hoop and being authentic, I believe that's part of the way of the visionary. And I don't know if people understand what being in the sacred hoop means. Could you tell us?
It's a wonderful term that comes from the Lakota traditions. If I show up, then I can pay attention to what has heart and meaning. And when I show up with my three powers, the power of presence, the power of communication, and the willingness to take a stand, or people know where I stand with them or what I stand for, by, and with, then I can pay attention to what has heart and meaning and come into the four-chambered heart. And when I'm showing up and connected to my heart, then I'm can tell the truth without blame or judgment. And staying in my sacred hoop is a metaphor in the Lakota tradition of speaking with spirit tongue, which is speaking from the authentic self, not from the false self that's fed by performance or editing or rehearsing or hiding.
Creating an image. Yes.
Right. So, to tell the truth with compassion or without blame or judgment, which is to say, you know, I'm jealous. I'm afraid of losing you. You know, there's the truth. No blame, no judgment, no attack. I'm feeling really judgmental right now, and I'm not reliable, and I don't trust what is going to come out of my mouth. So I just need some time to rebalance, and I'll come back. and no blame, no judgment, no attack. I love you so much, and it scares me, and I push you away, and I act out, and I don't feel good about that, and you have my commitment that I won't do that anymore because I know it creates unsafety.
Mm.
No blame, no judgment, no attack, but it's all I terms, and you know exactly where I am in my feeling or in my heart or in the authentic voice.
Oh, it would be so wonderful.
In my sacred hoop. So if I can show up and pay attention to what has heart and meaning, then I can tell the truth and without blame or judgment. And then the way of the teacher is then I can plan well, prepare well, but be open to outcome, not attached to outcome. Mm-hmm. Know that I've done the best job I possibly can, and then I can let go and be open to other solutions that I hadn't considered. Be open to outcome, not attached to outcome.
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so many people seem to have trouble being authentic. And I don't know if it's because they have lost themselves, they don't know who they are, and how to be authentic that way, but it's something we really need to bring back into being. As an important part of ourselves, that we to be truthful.
Yeah, and that's the work of the second half of life as well, you know, is how to collapse the false self system or shred the false self system and come home to who I really am. I love the phrase by Oscar Wilde. He says, might as well be yourself because everyone else is taken.
That's right.
Yeah.
but I hear this echo from people saying, but who am I? You know.
Yeah, well, that's the big existential question for, you know, who am I beyond what I do, beyond my roles, beyond my interests? And can I befriend myself and all the parts of myself is the beginning work of reclaiming the authentic self.
Oh, yes, accepting who you are and loving it just like it is.
Yeah, and remembering that I'm original medicine, so I don't need to compare or compete. I might as well be myself because everyone else is taken.
Yes. Well, Angelus, it's been wonderful. We do have to start wrapping this up, but I wanted to ask a little bit about the new book that you have out.
It's called Living in Gratitude. It just came out late at the end of the year at Christmas time, and so still is barely a year old, and it's really taking a look at there are 12 chapters, and each one deals with a perennial wisdom such as opening to guidance or embracing peace or cultivating attending to the heart, or how to begin anew, how to, grateful seeing, embracing nature, the power of equanimity. But it's really taking a look at the four portals of gratitude from around the world, which are blessings. We give gratitude for blessings, but we also give gratitude for learnings, and we give gratitude for mercies or the acts of kindness that have been extended to us, or compassion, or that we've extended to others, or forgiveness work, and then all the protections, how our family's been protected. We give gratitude for when our children are protected, our homes are protected, our community is protected. So
that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you. To all my listeners, I would urge you to read both The Fourfold Way, which had a huge impact on my life, and I know it will touch yours, and Living in Gratitude, her new book out. This has been Angelus Arion with us. Thank you so much, Angela.
Oh,
it
yes.
Was
thank you. And thank okay. you for your wonderful program and all the good work you do. I really appreciate it. It's been an honor and privilege to be with you today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Angela. And all my listeners, thank you for listening. May the sun kiss your face. May the waters bless your body. And may all nature sing in your presence. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.